Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast, your one-stop shop to learn all things medical speech and language pathology related. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your host. And today I'm sitting down with Katie Brown to talk about cognitive fatigue. And she's going to be sharing some assessment tools and management tools as it relates in the context of brain injury. Really excited for this topic. Katie's got some amazing resources that we're going to go over. And of course, she talks about PROMs, patient-reported outcome measures, which you know are my jam. I feel like they're such an easy thing for us to implement with amazing benefits to our practice, for our patients, and outcomes. Like, they're great. So we get to talk a little bit about those today. I'm so excited. All right. So yeah, that's enough out of me. I'm excited to get this episode started. So let's do that. Here's Katie. Welcome to the podcast, Katie. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to have you here. I love following you on Instagram. I love all the things you post. It's so wonderful, like feeding off of your brain that you share on Instagram. Such a good time.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm thrilled to be on your podcast and I can't wait to chat with you today.
Awesome. I'm really excited about our topic because you're talking about cognitive fatigue and we're going to be looking at like assessment and management of it in relation to brain injury. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that you're talking about today, like you've posted on, and it was the first time like I've heard of that concept, like the spoon theory. And it just really was eye-opening and like one of those things that's like, oh, yes, that's perfect. Like I have like 26 million people that applies to.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the things that I will talk about today is that this is such a common complaint and can really be used with almost every mild to moderate brain injury client.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, Katie, well, tell me a little bit more about you. Who are you? What do you do? All those wonderful things.
Okay. So I'm a speech language pathologist and I'm also a certified brain injury specialist and I practice in Buffalo, New York. I own a private practice called Neuro Speech Solutions, and in my practice, I specialize in treating aphasia and cognition due to neurological disorders. So specifically, I see a lot of individuals post-stroke and TBI. That's the majority of my caseload right now. And I've truly enjoyed just finding a niche and really learning as much as I can within that area. So outside of my private practice, I also love educating and advocating. I've worked with a few nonprofits and I provide monthly education about neuro disorders to an online group of acquired brain injury survivals through a nonprofit organization. And I am very passionate about helping other medical SLPs feel comfortable and confident in providing person-centered functional therapy. So I've made some materials that I sell on my website to help SLPs, and I also provide weekly clinical tips and ideas on social media as well.
Yeah, which are excellent. Thank you for your contributions to our field, Katie. Like, it's wonderful. I really appreciate it. I've learned a ton. Like, I'm really grateful.
Thank you.
All right. So let's dive in. Where do you want to start? Like, unpacking cognitive fatigue. In a nutshell, what is that? Because, like, when I just hear cognitive fatigue, I'm like, that's me at the end of every workday, right?
Yes. Yes. And there's a distinction between that, right? Like a lot of us, everyone experiences cognitive fatigue at some point, but it's very different compared to when someone has cognitive fatigue because of a chronic illness or a brain injury. One of the things that's so important to remember is that this is cognitive fatigue is not due to lack of sleep. That's not something that's going to fix. Like right now, I'm experiencing cognitive fatigue every day because I have a 6-month-old who keeps me up all night. But if I had a full night of sleep, that would resolve itself. But for individuals that have brain injuries, that's not enough. That's kind of just a band-aid to the overall issue. So really, I guess I want to start with why I became interested in the topic of cognitive fatigue. So, you know, over the past 2 years or so, when I began my private practice, I started seeing more and more mild TBI cases. And I kept hearing the exact same complaints from all of them, which were along the lines of, you know, my brain gets so foggy after working on something for a while, or I get so tired, I can't function anymore, and I keep making silly mistakes. And these are very common and valid complaints that severely impact these individuals' ability to go back to work, to be independent in their home, and their ability to socialize and participate in activities that they love. So I decided to dive into the research about it, and that's where I plunged down the rabbit hole that is cognitive fatigue. And I quickly discovered that these symptoms are very common. In fact, the literature suggests that the patient report rate of cognitive fatigue is around 70% post-TBI. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our patients at all levels of care are affected by this. And many report chronic cognitive fatigue as well. So I figured out that we as SLPs should be helping with the management and conservation of cognitive energy and therapy.
Awesome. Yeah.
So I'm sure you want to know what cognitive fatigue is, right?
Yes, please.
So cognitive fatigue is basically an increase in mental exhaustion that's caused by prolonged periods of cognitive activity. So it's essentially a rebound effect after completing activities that use higher level cognitive processes. I read about a theory called the coping hypothesis, and it's a theory that fatigue results from the compensatory effort that's needed to just meet the demands of everyday life in the presence of cognitive deficits. So essentially, our patients' brains need to work harder because of their injury, which then causes them to get mentally exhausted by doing everyday daily tasks that we would take for granted. So things that they were once able to do easily are now difficult to accomplish. And like I said earlier, it's important to note that this is not due to a lack of sleep. It's due to an impairment in the brain. And although lack of sleep can cause the same symptoms, getting more sleep will remedy those symptoms. So it's not the same thing that these individuals with brain injury are experiencing chronic fatigue from.
Now, Katie, if I can interrupt real quick, you're making this very clear distinction that it's like if they just got more sleep, that would fix their problems. Like, that's not cognitive fatigue. This is something very different that sleep won't remedy. Like, got it. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you say to the person, though, who is like, I'm not sleeping at night? Like, they are also complaining of, you know, that issue, too, because I feel like that comes up quite often, too, because that's a real burden on people.
Yes, because there are obviously a lot of reported sleep disturbances after brain injury as well. So it does go a bit hand in hand, but it's just not quite the same thing. You know, if their sleep does start to get better, they may still be experiencing cognitive fatigue throughout their day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, one of the things about cognitive fatigue is that it's naturally subjective. Right? It can range anywhere from mild to severe. It can last anywhere from a few hours to some report days at a time. And it can present itself in a lot of different ways. So some people may report becoming irritable. Some become more forgetful and have trouble concentrating. And some can have physical symptoms too, like headache or tension. One of my current patients in particular says that her sign of cognitive fatigue is that she gets silly. That's the term that she uses because she starts saying things to her husband that she wouldn't normally say, and she loses her filter and she gets easily upset by things. Mm. So, you know, the commonality across all of these individuals experiencing cognitive fatigue is just that it's debilitating, that this mental exhaustion can be very debilitating for them, and it can interfere with their abilities to effectively socialize and enjoy life activities.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I feel like you've really laid the stage here. So we have a really clear picture of what cognitive fatigue is and isn't, and the impacts that it has on patients and as they're trying to just go about their everyday life and how debilitating it is. And so another key thing that you mentioned is how subjective it is, right? It might be a huge problem in their life because it's affecting like this one thing that they love to do. Mm-hmm. And we might say, well, that's not really inhibiting you from self-care or higher ADLs that you need to do, right? So we might, in our minds as a clinician, like classify that as like not that big of a deal. But to them, it most definitely is. And we know that like when we're documenting and when we're writing our reports and stuff, we need to show how this impacts the patient. So what kind of tools do you use to report that kind of in a more standardized way rather than just, you know, the typical quote patient says or reports XYZ? Mm-hmm. Like, do you use any tools for that?
I do. So I'm glad that you asked that because I use quite a few patient reported outcome measures, which I know that you love. So I will share some of them.
I do.
So
it's true.
Yes. So I love patient reported outcome measures, whether it's cognitive fatigue or not. I always use some sort of patient reported outcome measure in all my assessments. But, you know, we need to get creative when we're assessing. In general, neuropsych type tests can be used to, you know, get at cognitive fatigue, but they're not applicable to everyday life, right? How many times are you going to ask them to make a trail of something, right? So they may be good for, you know, simulating cognitive overload, but I like to try to use other measures for really any disorder that I may see. So I compiled a list of both scales for fatigue and also for insight and awareness that I compiled. But I'll mention my go-tos here. So my number one favorite is the mental fatigue scale. It's a 15-question scale specific to TBI that covers emotional, cognitive, and sensory symptoms, as well as sleep. And it also asks questions to account for variations throughout the day. Hmm. They might notice a difference throughout the day. Another patient-reported outcome measure I like to use for fatigue is the Modified Fatigue Impact Scale, and that's a series of 21 questions that has physical, cognitive, and psychosocial subscales. And I like this one because it asks the patient to talk about the impact of fatigue and the effects it has on them. So like what you said, Leanne, one task might really be bothering them that's really important to them. And it might not seem important to us, but it's important to them. So the fact that it does look at the impact of the effect is great. So for example, some of the statements are things like, I've had difficulty making decisions, or I have trouble finishing tasks that require thinking. And then you ask the patient to respond on a scale of 0 to 4, 0 being never, 4 being almost always, to get at how much this cognitive fatigue is impacting them.
Do you pick one and use it, or do you sometimes do a few of them? Do you do like maybe, have you ever done like one at baseline and then like later on in your therapy, you're like, you know what, now that I've gotten to know this person a little bit better and learned a little bit more about them, I think I need to start measuring with this other scale too. Mm-hmm. Like, has that happened?
Yeah, so that's happened. In general, they're pretty quick to get through. So I will do both. And a lot of the times I will include the, you know, the total, the score in my goals. So as a way to, you know, say that they've made progress, I will say they will improve from a 30 to a 40 or something along those lines by self-reported measures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Excellent.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. So I love patient-reported outcome measures because it helps us tease out our clients' feelings and self-perception on their impairments. And it really helps to gain buy-in, too, in a population that may not be fully aware of their deficits in, like, the brain injury population.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I can touch briefly on insight too. So, you know, that with brain injury, insight and self-awareness are often impacted on some level. So I like to give the self-awareness deficit interview. Mm-hmm. It's cheap. It's only $3 or $4. So it's very affordable. And it's a structured interview with three topics where you first ask the patient about their deficits that they're noticing in general related to their injury and what the functional consequences are of their deficits. And then you start to ask questions and begin to select realistic goals for therapy. So now, in order to accurately score this, you do need access to a caregiver or close family member or friend, so that they can provide some insight and detail about prior level of functioning. Mm-hmm. That can be a downside if the patient doesn't have a strong support system, but I personally always recommend including caregivers in the evaluation process, so that way you can get their perspective as well and provide education too.
Well, good. All right. So that's pretty well rounded. So yeah, I really like that you're starting off by getting like information from the patient, what's important to them, how this is impacting them, and getting some insight information. So do you do any like impairment style assessments? What I think of as kind of like our go-tos, right? Because it was only after I started my practice and started learning from other SLPs that I started realizing that there's a difference. So, I'm just curious, like what other kinds of assessments might you do?
Sure. So I do rely mostly on, you know, patient reported measures, motivational interviewing, things like that. But, you know, lots of insurance companies need to see something standardized. So, you know, tests that I have used are things like the scan, the R-bands. For individuals that are really high level, I'll use, I just recently got the Favors, which I really like. I haven't been able to use it too frequently yet because I did just get it, but I do really like it because it, the people who might, you know, score within normal limits on something like the scan, this typically helps to tease out the deficits.
Yeah. Yeah. The Favors is much more complex.
It's difficult.
Yeah. And it's going to take a while. Like it's not something that you can, like the R bands is pretty straightforward and you can kind of get through that 30, 45 minutes. The Favors, I haven't actually given it as an assessment. I've used portions of it, like more like therapeutically, like as a task in therapy rather than as an assessment tool, because they're so meaty. They're like, there's so much to them, right?
They are very meaty, definitely. And, you know, but it says that they can be, that there's four subtests and that each can be given in 15 minutes.
Depends. It really does depend. Like how high level are we talking?
But for me, I might give one of those subtests during the evaluation period. And then you can always give more later on during treatment if needed. But yeah, so that's a way to kind of cut down on time too.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I like that. I remember back in grad school, one of my like clinic supervisors talked about the difference between the WAB, the Western Aphasia Battery, and the Boston Diagnostic Aphasia Examination. And she was like, the WAB, you know, you must give it in its totality to get the scores. But the Boston, it's a la carte. Like you can just take pieces here and there and you'll get scores for what you did. So
I love that, a la carte.
Right? So that's always stuck with me like all these years later. So now I can think of the Favors as a la carte.
Yeah. So, you know, these, the PROMs and, you know, maybe doing one of the Favors is a fairly quick way that you can get down to the bottom of cognitive fatigue and what areas it's impacting the individual in day-to-day life. And, you know, also their feelings and perception about cognitive fatigue as well.
Excellent. Good. I really love how you mentioned how like you're able to make your goals based on how they did on your PROMs. And that's a really easy, simple way to make measurable functional goals that are meaningful to the patient. Like, cause they're coming to you for cognitive fatigue. You're measuring cognitive fatigue and you're able to measure its impact on the patient and see that score change. And then reflect that back to the patient. Look, here's what you said on our first session, since we worked together, now you're saying it's impacting you less. Like, yay, therapy.
Yes. Yes, I love that because, you know, maybe I could give them another subtest of the Favors and their score doesn't change. But if their, you know, their PROMs changed, that it's showing that there's a meaningful impact in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's so cool. I love PROMs. They're so good.
Me too.
All right. Okay. Have we done kind of the assessment section justice or did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's good. Well, actually, I do want to add one thing is that cognitive fatigue, one thing that's interesting about it is that it is interdisciplinary, right? Mm. So cognitive fatigue can be effectively managed in lots of ways and across several different disciplines. You know, everything from medication in certain circumstances to psychology-based approaches, you know, but there is also evidence to support speech pathologists working on the management of cognitive fatigue too. I think that we have a unique opportunity to look at cognitive fatigue from a communicative standpoint, as well as overall cognitive functioning. Mm-hmm. So the situation that I provided earlier with my current patient that says one of her precursors to cognitive fatigue is that she gets silly. She also shared that she hates when this happens and she tries to stop herself from talking because it has actually caused rifts in her relationship with her husband. So this is a real life issue that although it may be cognitive based, it affects her relationships and her communication. So it's certainly within our scope of practice to work on this with our patients, but OTs can work on cognitive fatigue management as well. Mental health counselors and psychologists can too. And I think that's a unique way to be able to work with other disciplines and give our clients a really well-rounded therapy approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Okay. I'm really looking forward to the first intervention technique that you are planning on getting into called time pressure management.
Like, yes.
All those things sound very fascinating to me. Tell me more, Katie. Tell me more.
Okay. So I do want to give a little bit of backstory first, though, too. So we identify that there's a deficit and cognitive fatigue is affecting their function, and we need to work on some intervention. There is an article that I got lots of information from back, and it's dated back in 2011. The main author was Hicks. And this is where the researchers aimed to put together practice standards. So they interviewed a group of medical speech pathologists to see how they treat cognitive fatigue. And they identified four themes of cognitive fatigue management. And these were intervention structure, client and family strategies, monitoring by both the client and SLP, and lifestyle and daily activity changes. So intervention structure relates to the complexity level and environmental aspects within a therapy session. So things like removing or adding distractions were recommended, personalizing the length of therapy so as not to overtax the client, and providing information in various formats like verbally or visually. Mm-hmm. Client and family strategies is fairly straightforward. It involved educating the client and their family members, you know, about what cognitive fatigue is and how it can impact their day-to-day life, and also finding personalized strategies that work well for them. And then we had monitoring by a client and SLP. This is a very important aspect. So with brain injury, typically comes a lot of appointments and therapy sessions. So doing things like managing your schedule was a big difference maker for cognitive fatigue. Doing things like making sure there's a break between sessions for rest or avoiding back-to-back sessions. The idea here is for the client to gain self-awareness and hopefully begin to anticipate when they may experience cognitive fatigue. So then they can schedule their days based on this insight. And then also lifestyle and daily activities that has to do with changes that individuals can make to just in general make themselves more healthy and to help combat fatigue. So things like taking rest breaks, eating healthy, exercise, developing a routine to structure their life and make things more predictable. Those are all different types of things that clients can do.
Mm-hmm. Good. I like those. And I always... Whenever I would work on these particular things with patients, I always kind of felt almost like a life coach, right?
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
It tickled me and it made me a little nervous because I was concerned. I was like, okay, well, how much of this like is totally 100% stuff like SLPs we need to be working on, totally scope of practice. And then how much of this is me like maybe going into that like life coach style, or maybe SLPs are life coaches. Like, I don't know. What do you think, Katie?
So I love that because I recently had a graduate student, and the first week I have, like I said, I have a lot of mild TBI on my caseload, and he would say, okay, so I guess I don't know how to document what you did in therapy. And
Yeah.
And he definitely ended up learning a lot. And it's interesting to me that sometimes the best therapy doesn't look like therapy. You don't, you can't even really identify it. But that's where you really build the rapport and you really see a lot of big changes.
Mm-hmm. I love that you said that, that sometimes the best therapy doesn't look like therapy, because I feel like when we're being trained, we get into this idea that we need to report numbers on insurance. We need percentages. We need pluses and minuses. We need to know. And that's, to me, that's almost like a form of testing that patient with every little activity that you're doing. And they feel that, they know that, and they don't like it. I mean, I wouldn't, right?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't like it either. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It is a transition on how to document and report the skilled intervention that you're providing to them based on their needs and their deficits. And that just takes practice. And
it does take practice. Yes.
Like words, narrative, like you will be doing narrative documenting rather than like, you know, X amount out of 10 trials, this percentage of accuracy.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So back to time pressure management. Mm-hmm. The first thing that I do for all of my clients that have cognitive fatigue and cognitive, you know, like executive functioning deficits in general, is I like them to establish some sort of planner, whether it be electronic or paper, to plan and schedule their day. So again, if we go back to the practice standards from the Hicks article, it gives a good way for them to manage their routine and be able to have some insight into, you know, what's on their plate for that day and the week ahead. So I also have my patients use their planners to make expectation versus reality types of notes. And I don't know if there's a technical term for this, but this is what I call it. And I'll have a client, you know, write what they expect something will take or how long it will take or what they'll do, and then how the reality of it. How long it actually took, how they actually did. So that way that helps a lot with insight and awareness as well. Mm-hmm. But so the metacognitive strategy training protocol that I use often is time pressure management. And this aims to help the client in improving their self-awareness around time constraints and how it can affect and strain cognitive fatigue. Mm-hmm. So the basic framework is, first, we help our patients identify how long it will take to do something. So I use the expectation versus reality related to time. I'll have them write down how long they think something will take and then have them actually complete the task while timing it to record how long it actually took. And then I have them write this information in their planner next to the task, so that way they can they have a log of it and can use it to budget their time effectively in the future. Then it's important to identify and control the environment as best as we can. So questions to have the patient ask themselves can be, could I become overwhelmed? Could I become distracted? Where and when should this task be done? Is there anything that might interfere with me completing this task? And then working on actually setting up the environment for success. Next is to make a plan. So we think about which things need to be done before they complete the task and what they will do if they are under time pressure. So basically, what is the backup plan? And also, how will they know if they complete the task fully? And from there, they actually set the plan in motion and do it often. And then you can continue to apply this to new and more challenging situations. So patients can apply time pressure management to any personally relevant activity to help manage their cognitive fatigue.
Excellent. I love it.
Yeah.
It's very straightforward and very applicable.
Yeah, definitely. So an example of how I've used time pressure management in a fairly recent session is I have a patient who on occasion gets lost while she's driving. And I also want to preface this by saying that this individual was cleared by her neurologist to drive. She actually took a driver's test and she passed it. So she's safe on the road. But she kind of meanders when she drives, and she'll get lost and then she'll just keep turning instead of, you know, finding a way to get to where she needs to go. So she's always anxious when driving, thinking that she's going to get lost and late for appointments. A GPS didn't fully help her because she would get a little nervous if the GPS said, oh, changing the route. And yes. So we use time pressure management to make a plan and also have a backup plan. So first we determined how long it would take to get to the destination she needed. And then we always added extra time to account for traffic, you know, hitting lots of red lights, other unexpected things. Then we modified the environment as best as we could by making sure that she didn't have the radio on and that she was as relaxed as possible before leaving her house. And she also started to schedule appointments because most of the time she's pretty much just leaving her house to go to appointments. So she started to schedule her appointments to avoid rush hour traffic time whenever possible.
Nice.
To take that demand down a little bit. Then the plan we made for her was to put the location in her GPS and choose a route that she felt comfortable with. So she didn't like to drive on the highway, so she would find back roads to travel on and she would really study the route. And then she would leave early so she wouldn't have to hurry. And then we established a backup plan, which was if she got overwhelmed or lost, she wasn't just going to meander and turn randomly. She was going to immediately pull over at a safe place, reset her GPS, look at the route, and not just aimlessly drive around.
Excellent.
Yeah. So that's just a practical way that you can see how I use time pressure management with this patient. And it works for her too. So it's good. So before she leaves her house, she'll always go through all of these steps.
Nice. That's excellent. I love that she's invested in the process too, because I feel like every now and then I come across people who I feel like they kind of just want like the easy fix or a simple solution. And I'm like, well, we have to do things to account for these changes. And it's all about the preparation rather than trying to fix something after like the error has been made. So yeah, I find sometimes it can be a struggle to get people on board with becoming more prepared at the front end and doing the work at the beginning so that they can have the success later.
Yes, yes. I agree with you 100%. And I feel like working on personally relevant things is one thing that really increases their participation in therapy, right? So we used driving for her because that was something that she was having difficulty with. We didn't just do a random task that, you know, I pulled out of the air that she wasn't having trouble with. So she was able to see results fairly quickly. And the more that she conceptualizes and uses this strategy in different and varying ways, the more it generalizes, the more confident she becomes in applying it herself. And then we can discharge. Not as simple as that, but you know, the right. Overall concept, right? Because we're not always going to be hovering over our patients' shoulders. We have to set them free after a little bit. So their ability to actually do these things is very important.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I view therapy now as equipping our patients with the tools to be successful independent of our oversight.
Oh, I love that. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, girl, go ahead.
That's our goal.
And that's what I've learned from having these conversations with other SLPs. Like this is knowledge that I've absorbed from, you know, the hive mind, if you will.
Yeah.
But yeah, keep that, spread it more. I love it.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. So time pressure management. Love it. New to me as well. Thank you for teaching me something new, which is not hard to do. All right. Are we ready for the spoon theory?
Yeah, sure. Let's go into the spoon theory. So this is my go-to. It's one of the first things that I will work on with my mild to moderate TBI patients, that complain of cognitive fatigue, because it incorporates all four of the themes that I mentioned before that SLPs can do to help treat cognitive fatigue. So have you heard of the spoon theory, Leanne?
Only from you.
Okay, so before I started doing this research, I hadn't heard of the spoon theory as well, but it was actually originally developed by a woman who has a chronic illness. She has lupus, and her name is Christine Miserandino. I hope I did not just butcher her last name. But Christine, you know, a little backstory. It's called the spoon theory because at the time she was at a diner with her friend trying to explain what it feels like to have a chronic illness. So she grabbed the closest thing to her to use as a visual to illustrate her point, and that just happened to be spoons. And apparently she just ran with it, and it's become a big phenomenon in individuals that have chronic illnesses. So the spoon theory is great for our patients with chronic cognitive fatigue to begin managing and conserving their energy on their own. I'll give you a quick breakdown of what I do over the course of several therapy sessions and kind of, you know, what everything is. So first, let's talk about what a spoon is. A spoon is a visual aid to represent a unit of energy. So most people have unlimited amounts of energy to do what they want each day. But those with conditions like chronic illnesses and brain injuries need to budget their energy throughout the day. So the spoon theory works by allotting 12 spoons within a day, and that is all the energy that you have. Once you hit those 12 spoons is when you start to feel the effects of cognitive fatigue. You might have trouble concentrating, you might get irritable, all of those types of symptoms. So you need to figure out what activities you do during the day and how many spoons each activity takes. Okay, so this is completely dependent upon the person. So for example, I worked with a woman who just doing her daily morning routine, you know, getting up out of bed, showering, doing her hair, brushing her teeth, took 3 or 4 spoons from her. So that's, you know, 25% of the energy that she has for the day. So she would stay in bed for a lot. And then that in turn, you know, impacted depression and, you know, lots of other things. So one of the things, it was really holding her back from getting things done. And she dreaded using so much of her cognitive energy so early in the day. So we did workarounds like showering at night, picking out her outfit before she goes to bed, so she can take some of that decision-making out of, you know, right first, right in the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, what I like to do is I start out by having the person tell me everything they did yesterday, every detail. And we break it down and I ask, did that use any spoons? And if it did, I have them estimate how many. It's not a perfect science, and it's definitely based off of, you know, their own personal feelings about it and, you know, how they feel energy-wise. So I have them estimate how many, and we total up the amount as we go along. And the goal is to not go over 12. And typically, this first time around, they are way over 12. And so then we'll go back and I'll say, okay, well, yesterday, did you feel like you had trouble concentrating, or did you get irritable? Did you not complete things to the standard that you normally would? And typically the answer is yes. And we try to identify where that happened in their day. And it's typically right around the 12 spoon mark. So we do this with all of the regular activities. Like I'll have them do an inventory of what things they typically do during a week. So that way we know which activities take a certain amount of cognitive energy. So our patients can begin to use this as a framework to schedule their days. So they know, hey, I have to go to a doctor's appointment and I know that that takes 2 spoons. So now they know, okay, I have a doctor's appointment scheduled. That's going to take 2 spoons. And I have to go, you know, meet family for dinner. And, you know, having conversation in a big group really taxes me. That takes 4 spoons. Okay, so that's 6 spoons for my day. Now, how do I prioritize what I'm going to do? So I like to do this in conjunction with a planner so that way they can write down how many spoons they're using and have a record. And I also like to do the expectation versus reality concept again. So I'll have them write how many spoons they think a task will take and then how many spoons it actually took. So overall, you can see how it would be useful in helping gain independence in managing cognitive fatigue.
Yeah. My favorite thing about the spoon theory is how it takes something nebulous and something that we don't really think about or consider, and it makes it concrete, and it makes it tangible so that it can be manipulated for their benefit, right?
Yes.
How do you quantify the amount of energy that it takes to get up and shower and get ready for the day, right? Use a spoon. Like, what?
Yes. Yes.
So that's really fun. It's kind of like wild that she was like, here's a spoon. We're going to use this. This is going to like represent amount of energy to accomplish something.
Yes.
How many does it take you to do something, like pick a task?
Yes.
Right?
And you know, I have patients that they don't want to use spoons. They think it's a little odd. So I said, okay, well, whatever resonates with you, it does not matter to me as long as you're getting the concept. So I've had people that have changed it to like a gas tank. Like they run out of gas at a certain point. I've had a gentleman that used points, so he only had 12 points. It doesn't matter, right? The unit that you're using doesn't matter as long as you get the concept down.
Yeah. That's really good. And it gives that idea that you can run out of energy before you internally recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because we're powering along. We don't have that internal mechanism system often to be like, warning, running low.
Yeah.
Need more spoons. Oh, that's not something we can refill at this point in time.
Yeah.
So, I like that. So I really liked earlier how you were talking about like to help that one patient kind of manage her cognitive fatigue, because it took like, I think you said 3 or 4 spoons just for the morning routine.
Yes.
Was taking care of some of that at night and managing that decision-making, because like just on a personal front, like I got really into learning about decision fatigue.
Yes.
And like the more decisions you make during the day, like the more it just wears you down. So having simplifying and reducing the amount of decisions you have to make a day is a big bonus. So this is like a whole nother topic that like we could talk about that I'm really excited about that I don't know has like too huge of an impact on speech pathology, but like is super fun.
Yes. Well, I would love to hear more about decision fatigue. I do know it on a basic level, but I've not done a ton of research on it.
I wouldn't say I've done research so much as like, you know, well, I guess it depends how you define research, but anyway. So many tangents. Okay, back to spoon theory.
Okay,
go ahead.
So, you know, I got the idea of making a spoon. First off, I have a resource called Using the Spoon Theory for Cognitive Communication that I have available on my website. And I got the idea of using the spoon theory from a dear friend of mine who is also an SLP that is what's called a spoonie, meaning someone who uses the spoon theory. So my resource is Spoonie approved, but this friend of mine has lupus and, you know, she uses the spoon theory in her day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. It's not just for brain injury, but it's, you know, it was originally developed for chronic illnesses. So it's interesting when things can be applied to so many different people and it really resonates as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just really goes to show that like we might be experiencing unique aspects of living this life, but they're shared experiences.
Yes.
Right?
They are. Yes. But, you know, I also, one other task that I like to have my clients do with the spoon theory is use it as an educational tool for their friends and family. So I'll have them do exactly what the creator of the spoon theory did, and I will have them grab 12 spoons, sit down with their family member, have them start saying their day, and then taking away spoons as they're going along. So that way they can, you know, demonstrate to their family how cognitive fatigue impacts them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll have them, once the 12 spoons are gone, you know, they'll say, keep going. And they'll say, well, no, you can't do that anymore because you're too tired. Right. Mm-hmm. You can't go to the baseball game. You're too tired. It's going to take too much out of you. Or you can go to the baseball game, but you're not going to remember the last 4 innings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like giving people that opportunity to then make value judgments. like, well, you're out of spoons. You know, you're going to be exhausted. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to go?
Yes.
What will be the return on you expending the energy that you don't have? And some people might be like, it's totally worth it. I have to go to this game. It means a lot that I'm representing my family member who's playing, you know? And so, yeah, then they can work through, well, maybe in the future, for future games that I want to go to, I can plan better so that I have the energy to be fully present and enjoy it to its full potential.
Yes, I'm not going to run all those errands beforehand. Mm-hmm. That took up a bunch of my spoons. I'll do that on Saturday because I don't have much scheduled for that day, right? So yeah, so you're really getting the idea of how this can be used to manage and conserve, really, cognitive energy.
Yeah, I love it. That's so fun. I feel like this could be applicable to toddlers. You know, like when they crash and it's like, ooh, someone needs a nap, right? It's like you have like this little chart on the wall and it's like, okay, you did XYZ, you went and had a play date, go take two spoons off the wall. How many do you have left? You better choose wisely.
Yeah, I feel like I need that. I just made an emotions chart for my 2.5-year-old because we've been having meltdowns where he can't tell us why he's upset.
It's so tough too.
It is very tough, I know.
Right. I feel like I might need an emotions chart.
Yes. We all do at times, right?
True story. Right. Well, this is like some really good stuff, girl. I love it.
Good. I'm so glad that you like it. It's definitely become a really big passion of mine because this is, you know, something that I see. I work with individuals every day with this. So it's been a big eye opener. And, you know, anecdotally, my patients have said, you know, what a big help it's been for them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else you have?
I think I covered everything.
I feel like you're like, well, I have like 30 more minutes of material I could cover.
Yeah, but I know that we're running out of time. So
we'll just have to come back and do a part two because this is.
Ooh, I would love to do a part two.
Super, because this is so great. This is really helpful information. This is like applicable, easy to access, easy to implement, and like high rewards for your patients, which is like, that's what we want, right? We want to be efficient and effective therapists. And I feel like you've given us like tons of really great tools.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I do have, it can be difficult to explain the spoon theory to people. So I did make a resource, like I said, on my website, which is neurospeechsolutions.com /shop is how you can get to the resource. And in it, I have educational handouts. I have information, you know, different therapy tasks that you can do to help them understand the spoon theory and yeah, lots of good stuff. Some learning and self-evaluation type questions to, so that they really get the concept down.
Perfect. And we'll have links to all of that stuff. The articles that you mentioned, the assessment tools that you talked about, provided like the links for all of those. So we'll have those up in the show notes as well. So yay.
Yeah.
If people want to continue this conversation with you, Katie, what's a good way to reach out to you?
Yeah, of course. So I'm very active on Instagram. My handle is @NeuroSpeechSolutions. They can also reach out to me by email if they'd like, which my email is kbrown@neurospeechsolutions.com.
Perfect.
Yes.
Right. Well, I think that's everything. Thank you, Katie.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Super pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of the Speech Uncensored podcast. I'm so glad you joined us, and I hope that you got tons of this great information that Katie gave us that you can use in your practice tomorrow. Check out the show notes so that you can get the links to the resources that Katie mentioned. And I'd love it if you left a positive review on iTunes so that other listeners could find the podcast and learn and grow with us. Thanks for listening, and I hope we see you next week.